danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 261 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis. And with me, from Las Vegas, Nevada, fresh off a final two-table run in a $2,500 World Series of Poker event, is Andrew Brokus. How are you, Andrew?
Oh, I'm doing very well. Like you said, I'm fresh off of a final two-table run. And I'm not really a congratulations kind of guy. It just felt good.
Nice. That's the right attitude. That's the right attitude.
I think it helped that I was, it's sort of, on the one hand, I don't think there was ever much sense of entitlement on my part, because it was very clear to me the ways in which I ran good to get there. But it's also, so, you know, and part of you after you have a tournament success like that is like, oh, hey, tournaments are great. It's so exciting to get deep in them. Let's play more. But then you also sort of like, I had to run so absurdly good to make this happen, and it was still only 13th place. It also kind of makes you realize how stupid tournaments are.
Yeah. I remember being deep in the main event once and like thinking, man, if there was just like, if everybody showed up and your job was to name the card that came off the top of the deck, so you had like a 51-1, you know, a 1 in 52 chance of advancing, like, we had been through like sort of two cycles of that, and like, yeah, there was some skill involved, but like, I think if you showed up and said like, hey, you'll show up to a 2,500 player tournament, or a little bit more than that, I guess, given how multiplication works, and said like, oh, you'll win this tournament if you can correctly name, you know, the top deck, the top card in the deck, and then again after the deck is reshuffled, I think a lot of people wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people wouldn't want to do that. Like, the illusion of control, I think, is a big part of what makes people coming back to play tournaments.
Well, let's not forget the actual playing is fun also, in a way that your proposed game might not be.
Yes, that's right. Of course. But like, yeah, so you had to run absolutely stupidly great to make 10 times your money. So, nice work.
Yeah, and it's 8 times, really. And It's kind of funny, because it's the sort of thing that I might not have recognized some of it as run good, you know, 10 years ago or something like that, when I was much more amateurish at poker, because it wasn't, like, I don't know that I ever really did anyone that dirty in a preflop, you know, it just, like, got all in preflop and I sucked out at them in a nasty way. A lot more of it was sort of, I mean, it was a relatively tough field. I mean, certainly the last couple of tables were very tough, but, you know, my day one, I think I played it maybe 4 different tables on day one, and only one of them really was tough. Like, I had 3 pretty good day one tables, which is, I think, for that event, a lot of people were saying it's probably a tougher field than the main event, certainly less good structure than the main event. So, I mean, to get that right off the bat is nice. And then I had some lucky seat draws, like on coming into day two, I was the chip leader at my table, but there were 2 pretty good German players the rest of the table. Actually, there was 1 good player on my left, but like about half the table was sort of pretty clearly a tier below the in terms of my opponents, the 2 Germans and the 1 Scandinavian guy on my left. But the 2 Germans on my right were really the best players and had the most chips. And so having them on my immediate right was very helpful, especially since it was sort of like the bubble and I was able to put a little more pressure on them than I think I would have been able to do otherwise. There's just a bunch of things like that, in addition to kind of catching some lucky cards after the flop. But there wasn't a lot of that. Just, you know, we got all in with Jack-9 versus Kings and I made a straight or something like that. You know, it wasn't dirty in that sense. It was a lot more just like, and just having it in spots where it would have been very easy for me not to. You know, there's a lot of that stuff on day two where I was just, you're right, that would have been a great spot for me to squeeze, and it's perfectly reasonable that you jammed King 10 suited there, but my aces.
Yep. That's a kind of run good that cannot always, like, feel right, like run good, like right. Maybe making top pair when you didn't have to make top pair. It's like, oh, I raised with King Queen, and I hit a queen. And like, one pair isn't always easy to play. It's not like you made top set or something. But it's a lot better than King High, especially when stacks are short.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Good. So, yeah, I'm glad you had that experience. I'm glad you had that experience. And you are chilling for a couple days?
Yeah, I'm not real sure what the plan is. So it's we're recording now on Monday. I did choose not to play the Monster Stack, which, you know, maybe I'll start to feel FOMO when I see people at the final table of that or whatever. But just looking on Twitter yesterday and everyone talking about, you know, it's 10-handed and, well, that's really the main thing. But just like, I really didn't have that much FOMO at the time. And I mean, I just think it's tough. I know there are people who can do it. Like Ryan LaPlante comes to mind immediately as someone who will just, you know, bust final two tables of a tournament and immediately go like late register, you know, like, or another good example, Joe Catta.
John.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of them, but I know Joe Catta won the I think it was the $3,000 shootout, and then, you know, so that, I don't know how late that went the day before, but then like the next day 10 a.m. he's like showing up on time for the $500 Colossus right immediately after winning like a 3K bracelet, and you know, maybe that's just really pushy backers, but I think there's a sort of a level of dedication there that, I mean, I just don't fully trust myself to like play with total heart when you go from playing like 20k 40k and then you're back playing like 25-50 or whatever the Monster Stack is starting at. I just felt like maybe taking a day or two rather than expecting myself to play my very best at what's just not going to feel like big stakes to me immediately was a wise thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, given that I've already said something about this on Twitter, like as somebody who has a little bit of the action, I'm happy with that decision. You know, like I'm sure you would have, like, even you, like, you know, reading two books and tweeting and playing a little fast and loose is probably a favorite in that field, but like realistically, given what psychology is like, I'm very happy that you're just kind of chilling and admiring cactuses or whatever you're doing for a couple days, and you're gonna get back to the tables.
Yes, I mean, that was Sunday was when I declined to play the Monster Stack. I don't think I'm gonna play today, which is Monday. We may even go out of town for a few days, although the PLO 8 is tomorrow, so also maybe not. I think the PLO 8 will be a little easier for like a getting back into the swing of things tournament. I think it'll be a little easier to do that in a non Hold'em game, so I think that has some appeal.
And the field will be like different there too, so that'll be kind of fun.
Yeah, and it's it's an 11 a.m. start this year, which it typically been an afternoon tournament, which is less good for me. I'm not as sharp later in the day. I mean, I'm fine at 3 p.m. I'm just not as sharp at like 2 a.m. or whatever, you know, whatever time that tournament plays until. So the 11 a.m. starts are really much, much nicer for me. And that's I think it's the first time the PLO 8 has been an 11 a.m. start. And that's the other WSOP event in which I have previously made the final two tables. So I think I, you know, overestimate my chances in that tournament for that reason. But I do enjoy playing.
Yeah. It's a good tournament. People really, I mean, we've talked about this before. A lot of the people who play it are not sitting around playing tournaments all day. Yeah. Or if they are, they're not playing PLO 8 tournaments all day.
Right.
So like to have people who both know what they're doing in PLO 8 and know what they're doing in tournaments, is rare. And I think I've said this so before on the air, but it was years ago, but so I'll repeat it, but keep it short. Like the last time I played a straight PLOA tournament, like I had people just rolling their eyes at me and then like, you know, shuffling off to nearby tables to like make fun of me. And I was like, oh, maybe I should check out that hand. And then I would go check out the hand and my play was like clearly right by like several big blinds. It's not easy to do. And like, it's, and these are like name players who are doing this. It's just, a lot changes when the stacks are not 100 big blinds or also not 10 big blinds. And also it changes when it's not Hold'em. We've talked about this on the air before, but things like defending your big blind, it's a lot different having 40% equity when, you know, you very rarely bust as having 40% equity in Hold'em. I think you should play that tournament and it will be fun and you should record a lot of hands and we can talk about them on the air and alienate 90% of our listeners who don't care at all about the game.
Oh, I think you're badly overestimating how many people fall into that category. I think a lot of people, you know, those non-Hold'em discussions, people always enjoy those. I shouldn't say everyone. I think that's popular.
I think you're overgeneralizing for the people who like actually reach out to you. Like the people who just like skip the podcast, like the people who just sort of hear what the strategy segment is and then, you know, flip ahead to Adam Carolla or whatever. Like they don't generally tweet to you to say like, hey, I usually like the podcast, but I don't care about this. Like,
yeah, that's surely correct.
Yeah, I don't know. I could be wrong. I think, no, it's probably not 90%. I think a lot of people just like to hear about poker strategy, and some people like the contact with games they don't play every day. But I also think a lot of people do not care at all and would rather we be talking about Hold'em.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right about that.
Want to talk about Hold'em?
I do, but first I want to talk about Tournament Poker Edge. I've already got lots of videos on Tournament Poker Edge, as do plenty of other very accomplished professional players, including Matt Hunt, who was the runner-up, I believe, in the $1,000 30-minute Big Blind Ante WSOP event that was going on at the same time that I was making my deep run in the 2500. But I did record loads of hands from the 2500. I'm looking forward to doing a full hand history review all the way from the beginning of the tournament through my elimination in 13th place. And that'll be going up in Tournament Poker Edge, I imagine, before the end of the year. Obviously, I haven't recorded it yet, but one of the many, many benefits to becoming a member of Tournament Poker Edge, which you can do at tournamentpokeredge.com. I do also want to remind people that we are going to, I am going to be hosting a Nickcast meetup at 10 a.m. at the Gold Coast Bowling Alley. This is going to be the Saturday of the main event, which is, I should look at the calendar, which is going to be Saturday, July 7th. That is, I believe, day 3 or maybe day 4 of the main event. So obviously I hope to be playing, in which case I'll probably just be making a brief appearance, but I'm sure there'll be lots of other listeners there. We always get a good crowd. And that's going to be 10 a.m. to noon at the Gold Coast Bowling Alley, which if you've never been to the Gold Coast is not at all hard to find. Just find some stairs, walk up those stairs, and you'll be in the bowling alley. And there probably won't be too many people there at 10 a.m., and we're a pretty easy group to spot.
Yeah, the people who are there at 10 a.m. tend to be pretty into bowling, though.
That's true. And that's, yeah, don't be deterred if you don't enjoy bowling or have never bowled. I think in the history of the meetup, which we've done there maybe 4 times now, no one has ever picked up a bowling ball. Not to say that you aren't welcome to, but bowling is not really an integral part of this meetup. It just happens to be a convenient, free location with cheap coffee available, which is appealing to people at 10 in the morning. Other bit of bad news for us anyway, it looks like Carlos is probably not going to be there. He ended up getting an opportunity to, well, I think part of it was his summer got off to kind of a bad start. He bubbled a few tournaments that he would have rather not bubbled, and he had some opportunities to do some, I'm not sure if it's tutoring or substitute teaching in Portland, but yeah, he's going to be up there. So unfortunately, we're going to be having a Nickcast meetup without Carlos and without Nate, but I will do my best to hold things down for the Nickcast crew. And as I said, we always get a lot of interesting listeners and sometimes former guests on the show as well showing up. So I think it'll be a good crowd regardless, and I hope to see you there on Saturday, July 7th.
So among people who just showed up to be substitute teachers in Portland, how many of them are there because Bitcoin is down?
Yeah, Carlos is probably not the only one. Well, as Carlos would say, it's not down, it's on sale.
It's on sale, excuse me.
All right, so hands, I think I'd probably be most interesting. Well, there's a few. The first one I'll talk about because it intersects with a hand that we discussed, or I think it's a concept related to a hand that we discussed on episode 260 when we had Carlos on the show. We talked about, you know, someone made a raise for about a quarter of his stack rather than just going all in, and I ended up defending with Jack 10 offsuit from the big blind, and we talked about the idea of sort of you have a hand that you wouldn't have called a shove with, but because the player didn't actually shove, even though he did make a raise that probably is committing his whole stack, you know, he is giving you the opportunity to call and see a flop from the big blind. And there might be some situations, if you have the right kind of hand, where you can actually make use of that opportunity. And a similar spot came up actually on the bubble with, I don't remember exactly how many, but a pretty small number, like, you know, maybe three or four players to go out of 160-something before we make the money. I had a very large stack, but the player in this hand was short. He had 16K to start the hand, and we were at 816, so we had 10 big blinds. So this player, we're at the 800, 1600 level. He has 16K, so he has exactly 10 big blinds. He's in the cutoff, and as I said, we're quite close to the bubble. So, I mean, just off the bat, he shouldn't be playing very many hands, period. When he has a 10 big blind stack on the bubble, he should largely be focused on making the money, and he needs a very good hand to enter the pot at all. If he is going to enter the pot, so, I mean, he ends up raising to 5K and leaving himself 11K behind. And I think that's... on the one hand, like, maybe he's thinking of that as sort of a conservative play, like, oh, I can make it 5K, and if someone just calls, there might be certain flops where I end up not getting all in and not putting myself at risk of elimination on the bubble. It's hard to, you know, say how viable of a strategy that is. I think, though, there's a pretty big risk there, which is that you give the big blind the opportunity to call, right? So this ends up being a raise of only about three big blinds, which means that the player in the big blind that happened to be me is getting a pretty good price to call this raise. And, you know, if you think about the kinds of hands he's going to be, like, maybe he just has aces and he's trying to, like, induce some action or something like that. But with any hand other than aces, he really doesn't want that kind of action. Like, I think even with kings, he's probably better off just winning the blinds and antes than he is, you know, letting the big blind see a flop or going to showdown against a range of hands that's going to have a lot of ace-x in it. If you think about, like, what kinds of hands are going to give him action, it's going to be sort of an ace-heavy range. And honestly, like, the risk of getting eliminated on the bubble are the consequences of that are high enough that even with a hand as strong as king, certainly with slightly weaker hands, you know, he probably doesn't really want to be encouraging action. So I don't think this raise to 5K is like a encourage action sort of raise. They're just are basically not, this is like, he doesn't really have hands that want to encourage action. I think if anything, the raise to 5K is either just, you know, being weird, or maybe he thinks it's going to look stronger or something, or it may just be that he actually thinks it's a defensive thing. But I think that's actually kind of unlikely, at least if the big blind plays well. I think going all in is actually a safer option. Just sort of maximizing your immediate fold equity is actually safer than putting yourself in a spot where you're going to mostly be putting your stack in after the flop anyway, but you're giving the big blind the opportunity to see the flop. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, it does. It does. It's also, like, interesting to me. Sometimes people think that, like, they understand that they really shouldn't bust, but, like, they just don't think that you're actually allowed to fold ace queen or something. So it's like, oh boy, it's like, ugh. I've got ace nine suited in the cutoff. I can't fold that, but folding's bad. So I'll make a 5K. It's, you know, like, if you think people are going to mess with you, like, you really just can fold the first time. Mm. Or go all in if that's the right thing to do. But yeah. I think that's right. Certainly he could do this with aces, but it's pretty hard to get aces. And it's pretty easy to get, you know, something from ace jack to ace seven or whatever. Or yeah, I mean, I think pairs, like pocket sixes, like, surely he's just shoving or folding those, right? Like, I can't imagine he would do that with sixes. Yeah. I can imagine a lot of things. I've seen a lot of things, but I think probably he would just shove.
Or fold. I mean, I think it might just be a fold on the bubble.
Oh, I would fold. Yeah.
But you're saying if he plays it.
Yeah. Surely, right?
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's a fold. I think it's a fold. I don't know.
I mean, it depends on the noise. I don't remember exactly how many players were left, but yeah, it's probably a fold.
Yep. Good. But so you call.
Yeah, he makes it 5K, and I have 10-9 of diamonds in the big blind. So, I mean, I do think the raise to 5K is pretty, like, I think he's not necessarily aces, but I do think it's a very strong range that's raising here. And I'm not going to be just calling anything. Like, this is not a, you know, I'm defending 80% of hands in the big blind or something. But 10-9 of diamonds is the kind of hand that flops pretty nicely. Like, I'm getting a pretty good price, and I'm going to have a pretty good idea, I think, of what's going on the flop. I do actually anticipate, even though I don't think he's ever folding if I shove to a flop, like, I can't imagine he's raising to 5K and folding to a shove, but I do think there may actually be some opportunities to take him off of hand after the flop. I don't think a lot of them, but if we sort of factor in like just getting to realize my equity and then on top of that, like occasionally finding a bluffing opportunity. I mean, I think getting, you know, he's getting the kind of price I'm getting, like 3-1 or something like that. You know, I think I probably will get 25% of the pot with 10-9 suited.
Yeah. And if we're right that he's probably not doing this with very many pairs, like it's not that hard for the board to come low. And he can call it off with ace high, but he doesn't have to. And especially if you have a huge stack, like you probably didn't get it by playing tight. So like he might be planning to call it off a lot, but like when the board actually comes 9-6-3 deuce deuce and you set him in, like is he actually going to say like, oh, this guy is bluffing enough? Or is he just going to say like, yeah, fucker played 9-8, you know? Like, I mean, or like you can maybe value bet fours or, you know, it's there's going to be chances to bluff. I think that's right.
Yeah, well, and the board that you mentioned, I would actually have top pair. But, you know, if we make it, like, say the flop comes 8-7 deuce, I think I can just open shove, and I've got at least an open-ended straight draw, even if he does have aces. And,
yeah.
You know, is he going to call with ace-king in that spot? You know, maybe, but there's at least a chance he doesn't.
Yeah. And then there will be some boards. Like, what's tricky, and what is also relevant to PLOA is finding the right time to bluff. This is like a big PLOA skill, is like figuring out when your bluff actually has a chance to work, or alternatively, like on the other side, when there's basically no way he can actually fold to a value bet on the turn because he has too many hands that have too much equity. And if you know sort of, as you do, if you sort of know what board textures are like and how that interacts with his likely range and when he can fold and when he can't fold, you're going to do a much better job of getting fold equity when you want it and not getting folds when you don't want them.
The flop ends up coming ace queen jack with one diamond, which strikes me as a flop that smacks him so hard that despite the fact that I have an open-ended straight draw and a backdoor flush draw, I don't think I can just open shove it. Like I need to win the pot about 33% of the time, given the amount that I'm going to be putting in. Like if I knew I have no fault equity, I would need to win 33% of the time, and I don't think I will. So yeah. I don't think I have much fault equity on a shove. Like I think this board just smacks him so hard that he's, and you know, I often don't even have eight clean outs because he might have ace king or something like that.
Yeah.
And so my plan is actually to check and fold to a shove. Mm-hmm. However,
that's a really good play, by the way, is like not having that sort of spinal reflex to just put it in when you flop a draw, like especially if what we said is right and he really doesn't have pocket sixes here. Like what are you folding? You're not folding. Nothing's folding.
Yeah, I mean, I would say probably folding. Like the single most likely hands that he could fold would be, you know, pocket tens, yeah. Which I blocked pretty hard.
Yeah. Pocket kings, maybe. Like,
yeah.
I'm not sure he's actually folding, but he could. Yeah. Like, king, queen? He probably doesn't have king, queen. He would probably just fold king, queen, or shove it. Yeah.
Well, if he does have king, queen, I think he might call that off. If he's got a gutter, too.
Yeah, especially, like, with your beard. I don't think you can king, queen. It's a beard call, I think. Yeah, good. That's a really nice check. Planning to fold to a shove. A lot of people can't do that. And it's kind of similar to the thing pre-flop where like people say, oh, I can't bust here, and then like lose half their stack with ace jack anyway because they also can't fold ace jack in their heads. Like, you know, it's a draw is a draw. Like the reason you play it aggressively is because you usually have fold equity, or you can end up like draw over draw. Like the times when the other guy shows up with 10-8 matter more than you might think to your equity here. But when he doesn't have anything other than a better made hand, some of which block your outs, then you just check and fold. But what actually happened, Andrew?
He actually bet only 5K, which yeah. I'm still, so now the pot is like 11-ish, a little, maybe 12-ish, and he bets 5K. So I'm still not getting, you know, if we assume that he's always going to shove the turn, I'm still not really getting the right price to try to chase a draw, because I'm only going to have at most 8 outs once if we assume he's shoving the turn. So you know, 15-ish% chance of getting there on the turn. You know, maybe sometimes the turn is like a diamond or a card that pairs me and I can put it in. But still, I think like if we assume he always shoves the turn, it's probably still not a call. But I think there's a chance that he doesn't. Like, I think there is some chance this is kind of like a defensive bet and he's going to check behind the turn and I'm going to get to see two cards. I also think there's, you know, the good chance I win his other 6K if I do make my straight. He's going to have a lot of hands that are going to have trouble folding if the straight gets there. And I don't think it's completely impossible that he ends up checking behind the turn and folding the river if it is some kind of defensive bet. Or if he has like, you know, king queen, there might be some runouts, or jack 10, something like that. You know, there might, and I don't know that he's actually playing those pre-flop. I guess I mentioned pocket 10s and pocket 9s before, which I'm blocking, but you know, I'm not expecting this to happen often, but I don't think it's completely impossible that he actually checks behind the turn and folds the river.
Yeah. Yeah. And he could also have like, we talked about like ace 10, ace king. He could have like if you hit a 10, if you had a king, you actually have a straight, but if you hit a 10, there's only three of those, but that can really improve your bluff ability. Mm-hmm. So there's that. Like a nine can also sometimes. It's not a lot, but I do heartily agree with you about everything you just said.
So I called the 5K. Now we're looking at like 24K in the pot and six behind, six in his stack.
Tournament poker, it's so goofy. It's
the turn is an offsuit six. No help for me. I check with the intention of folding to a shove, and he checks behind, which is great. The river is an offsuit three, so I still have just 10 high, but at this point, I really doubt he calls a shove. Like, I don't see what hand, you know, it's sort of, I mean, maybe he's playing king 10 really strangely. I think even king 10, even if he has the nuts, I don't see why he doesn't just stick it in on the turn for a quarter pot. I happen to have the one hand that might actually fold to a turn shove, but like, there's not a whole lot that I'm calling flop and folding turn with. And any hand other than that, like if he has pocket aces, I think he wants to just stick it in on the turn rather than, you know, give me a free roll to a gut shot or something. I really can't see him slow rolling the turn with anything. I can't see the three ever improving him. It's hard for me to imagine what he checks behind the turn with that calls a shove on the river.
Yeah, I mean, we should say this person is already, like, we can construct a rationale for what he's doing, but there's also a chance that there's an element of button clicking going on here. And, like, if he thinks that, like, you're real goofy, like, what if he has ace queen, you know? Like, he could say, oh, you know, like, I mean, he should still shove the turn, but I don't know. I spent 3 days in Las Vegas. You'll see a lot of weirder stuff than somebody checking behind the turn with ace queen in this spot. Like, I probably think a call is a little more likely than you think it is here, but this is a really mandatory bluff. Really, really mandatory bluff. It needs to work a fifth of the time. It's going to work more than a fifth of the time.
Yeah, that's also, it's sort of high. Like, I think there's a decent chance this works like 80% of the time, but I don't need it to work anywhere near that often. Right? You
know, yeah, I'd say like 50-50, but maybe I'm just like, yeah, I trust your judgment. I mean, I would have said something more like 50-50 before you had given me sort of that rationale. So that's that. I think you really, really have to bluff here. And you feel kind of stupid when, like, it's a bluff that looks hopeless when it doesn't work, but it's not hopeless at all.
I did shove. He tanked for a long time and then folded pocket 10s face up, which, you know, this again is a good example of running good. Even though I missed my draw, like, I happened to get into a spot. And part of it was, you know, I think he would have been better off just shoving this pre-flop. So it's not like there was no, you know, it's like a skill differential contributed to the outcome here. But at the same time, you know, for him to have pocket 10s when I have a 10 in my hand and to get this board, and for it to kind of play out in a way that I am able to end up winning the pot, despite having, so like, I massively outperformed my equity here. And part of that had to do with, with the line that I chose to take, but part of it just had to do with the board and the way the board fell and the cards that he happened to hold, which again, is just, just an element of run good. Like, I'm not going to win this pot very often, obviously, but he has 10s and I have 10-9 suited.
Yeah, it's not easy to... I think he almost could not, sorry if you're listening, but if you're the villain, I think you almost could not have chosen a worse thing to do on the flop. Like, I think checking is fine, actually. Like,
yeah, I think he can check a lot.
I'm not saying it's great, because, like, a lot of hands, I don't know. like, first off, if he shoves, you have to hold hand, like, hands not only like the one you have, which is pretty rare, but like Jack Nine. Are you calling Jack Nine? Probably. Maybe at least.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I'm not calling flop.
Pre-flop. Yeah. But are you calling it on the flop? No. No, you are not. It's, I mean, I don't think so. Are you calling Jack Nine here?
Pre-flop, yes. On the flop, no.
No, on the flop. So, calling a flop shove? No. Are you even calling Jack 10 to a flop shove?
Probably not. I mean, if I'm not calling with this, I don't think it really, Jack 10 has more equity than this does.
Yeah, so like I think shoving is fine. I think checking and doing stuff on the turn is also fine. I think just doing this is not fine. I think this is very not fine.
I just think he really just needs to shove pre-flop. I mean,
getting
called by 10-9 suited, like a lot has to go wrong for him to lose that pot. But, you know, getting peeled by like ace-4 suited is really bad for him. And, you know, getting peeled by king-10 is bad for him. Like, those are all hands that I'm folding to a shove. But if he gives me this price, I'm probably going to call with him.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the turn check, I think, is okay.
Yeah.
The pre-flop and flop are both catastrophic, I think. Very, very poor. Yeah. Anyway, and if you're listening, I'm happy to share a zillion hands that I've played equally poorly, but this is a poorly played hand.
I will say he was very nice about it. So I don't typically show hands in general, or certainly not, you know, showing bluff just to needle people or something like that. But he did. He sort of enticed it out of me because when he folded, he said, if you're bluffing here, you'd have to be a genius or something like that. And I was like, well, then. and then, so this was like right before break. So we actually like walked out to break, you know, together, not together, but I was like right behind him. And then he, I'm not sure if he realized it was me when he held the door, but then I was like, oh, and he even holds the door for me. So then we did actually chat about it a little bit. And I assured him that I did think it was correct for him to fold the river. We didn't really talk about what I didn't think was correct about the hand, but I was like, yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard for me. Like, I have to have exactly this hand, you know, in order to be bluffing the river. You are going to be behind quite a lot, and I don't think you want to be calling it off on the bubble with that. He also went on, he shoved his last three big blinds, which again, this could have been a mistake, but as short as he was at that point, he might not have been able to fold into the money, but he shoved his last three big blinds with, like, I think it was ace-6 offsuit. I called him with king-10, and he commented, well, you can't bluff me this time. And he did actually double up and go on to make the money. So that's the happy ending to the story, is he did cash despite this and took some chips from me.
Very good, very good. So he was rewarded for all his assuredly excellent play up until this hand, and so that's nice.
Indeed.
Yeah, someday Tommy's going to write a book where, like, the final proof of somebody's good mental game is that they can hear something like this and not show the bluff. That's, I don't think I know many people who could resist at that point.
Yeah, I've never, like, the time when I'm most likely to show my hand is in a, when I get away with some sort of absurd bluff. I actually can think of one instance where I didn't, because of who the villain was and not wanting to make him feel foolish, but it took a lot of willpower. And I typically, this is a very good way to get me to show a bluff, is to tell me how smart I would have to beat him bluff. All right, so hands that didn't go so well for me. I'm gonna skip past this one that I put on here for time reasons, but the one that ended up being pretty consequential, and Nate and I have discussed this a little bit by email as well. I've discussed it with one or two other people. This was at the 5K, 10K level. This is towards the end of the night on day two. I don't think I have the exact chip lead, but I'm quite close to it with, I think maybe we may have six tables remaining. And I have like 1.3 million, 1.2 million chips. My opponent has a little over 500K, which is still an above average stack. We're at the 5K, 10K level. He's a youngish Russian player, doesn't seem to speak English that well. I think just that combination of young Russian and at the World Series of Poker is enough to conclude, like, probably an internet pro. I don't think there are too many people fitting that description. He certainly didn't look like just a rich kid, which, I mean, maybe there's some just sort of, you know, rich young Russian poker fans who are over here playing who aren't actually that good, but I think the vast majority of European, especially the kind of the lower the median income in the country is, which I know, like, yeah, there's some very wealthy people in Russia, but I think in general it's not a country where there's a lot of people with, you know, thousands of dollars to blow on a hobby.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the more
I told you.
Good.
Yeah.
You told us this about Sweden.
Yeah. It's like, oh no, I'm just here for some show. Like, what? that's a crazy beat. Anyway, or good beat. Anyway, yes, but I think you're right. He's probably very good at poker.
Yeah.
I mean, or like, you know, or like he's like somebody's friend, like the sort of tag along guy. And I don't mean to like disparage. I've in some sense been this person, but not Russian. Sometimes where like, you know, like six people are coming over and like three of them are mega crushers and the other three are like kind of okay. And like, you know, he's just in this tournament, but like even there, he's like a serious poker player.
So he opened limps and I have ace
blind versus blind.
Sorry. So it folds to him in the small blind. He opened limps and I have ace queen offsuit in the big blind. I've raised his limp. But at least I think we've had two other times that this occurred. I raised once and checked once, and the time that I checked, I won the pot with a flop bet. And then the time that I raised, he folded pre-flop.
And you have a huge stack. He has how many chips?
He has 500K, which is above average.
Yeah,
50 big blinds.
So 50 bigs. Yeah, I mean, so you got to raise. You have ace queen. It's a monster. He's young, presumably. Yeah. I would raise whatever your standard size is here. I probably wouldn't try to get cute and switch up and try to do something sort of exploitive with a new raise size. I would have one raise size here and I would use it with this hand. How about that?
Fair enough. So I think there's quite possibly a case for having a larger than 3x raise size here. I think, you know, Carlos talks, although I think it's often for exploitive reasons, but Carlos talks about using a slightly larger raise size here, but I just made it 30. And he called.
I think that's good. I think a little bit bigger is fine, a little bit smaller is fine if you're aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it. Bigger has its merits, but here I think you would rather just raise with a few more hands, like the extra V pipping you can do if you make it a little bit smaller is good. And I would do that. So yeah, 3x is very good, I think.
He calls. And we see a flop, which is 5-4 deuce with two clubs. I did not have any clubs in my hand, but I do have ace queen.
Yeah.
He checks to me, and this, I think, is actually the critical point in the hand. Even though the pot isn't that large yet, I think the biggest decision is whether or not to bet the flop. And I can say that in the moment, it seemed like a pretty straightforward spot to bet, and we can talk about why, but the feedback I've gotten from several people, including you, is that it actually should be a check.
I didn't go so far as to say it should be a check. I would say I would have checked. I would have had a justification for checking, so it wouldn't have just been like, I missed the flop and I'm scared because I'm in a tournament. I would have had like specific reasons for checking, and I would have checked. And even after I thought about it a little bit more, I would still check. So that's not to say, I still sort of trust your instincts a lot, and I'm not saying that a check is definitely right. Can I tell you why I would check?
Yeah, please.
So if this player is good, he's not going to automatically like barrel. Like, what can go wrong for you if you check? Well, you can give free cards. That's not that bad because you dominate a lot of the hands he would limp and call pre-flop. What's really bad about that is that it gives him some bluffability. But if you're balancing pretty well, then like you can also bluff those cards, and he can't like just fire with abandon like on any run out, you know? So I don't think that you're opening yourself up to getting bluffed like too often. Like, you can even beat some value / protection bets on the turn. Mm-hmm. If you check, like, you could easily check and he could value bet a worse hand on the turn and you could call, and that is fine. So some of the benefit of betting is also a benefit that you get by checking. So next question is, like, if you check this, are you checking too many hands? And I think the answer is no. You have a bunch of overpairs to the five that you will really want to bet. And also, like, I don't think that your thinking pre-flop is like, oh, I've already raised him twice, I should, like, let up. Like, I think if you have 10-5 suited here, you're not going to raise all the time. You're probably going to raise sometimes, or at least maybe. And, like, you have 6-5. You have ace-deuce. You have, you know, you have pairs. And you have pairs that are going to want to protect. So you have a lot of hands that are, like, kind of roughly as good as ace-queen, but really, really want to bet here. Well, I don't know if they want to bet more than ace-queen, so I'll slightly retract that. But I don't think that if you check ace-queen, you're checking too much. Meanwhile, you know, you can hit an ace or queen on the turn. That's good. You can hit your gutter. You know, it's like a little bit dicey, but yeah, I think that's, especially because you have a position, that's good. I think if you get check raised, you're going to lose some money at least sometimes. Like, not saying that you can't call or that you can't fold, but you know, when you fold, you're almost always folding away some equity. And when you call, especially if this guy plays well, you can have a little bit of trouble after that, even though ace queen is still, like, a very good hand. So I think a lot of good things happen on later streets if you check. And I think given the opponent profile, he's not going to, like, accidentally do the thing that puts you in a real tough spot, which I think is over bluffing turn and river. So I think, like, a plan to call once or on certain textures call twice, or, like, value bet if it gets to you on the turn. Like, I think playing the turn after you check the flop is going to go pretty well. And betting the flop is not a catastrophe, but I just think checking is better. How do you like my reasoning?
I think that's very compelling. The one thing that I'll add to it, which only strengthens your case, and this is the reason why, you know, my judgment is, I appreciate your willingness to defer to my judgment, but I think this is a thing that I've, a mistake that I've made in important tournament situations in the past, is, like, not fully appreciating the importance of kind of, like, pot control in these big stack confrontations. Again, the pot's not actually that big yet. Like, it's just been, you know, just a single raised pot, blind versus blind. But just, you know, a decision of whether or not to bet the flop right now when you're only starting with 50 big blind stats. So if you're playing, like, a cash game, as I often do, with, like, 300 or 400 big blind stacks, like, a flop bet into a single raised pot is not really that much of a commitment towards playing a large pot.
Yeah,
but with 50 big blind stacks, when there's antes, and, you know, so now there's already, like, 8 blinds in the pot or close to it, and, you know, betting another 2 as I did, and then getting check raised, like, suddenly the pot is quite large, and even if it is slightly profitable to bet call ace queen here, like, chippy V wise, it's not really the thing you want to be doing for a 100 big blind pot when there's 5 tables left in a WSOP event, I think. I just think I don't always translate as well from just, like fully appreciating the, I don't know if you call it ICM or whatever you want to call it, tournament considerations. I think there's a lot of spots where I do know how to do it, but I think sometimes there's some sort of, like, post-flop spots that are obvious to me in retrospect where I'm like, oh, that was actually a really critical juncture where, you know, the pot got a lot larger because you bet rather than checked. And it's not always obvious to me in the moment that that's what's happening. And it's something I want to be more conscious of going forwards.
Yeah. And notice that, like, you understand this, but, like, for our listeners, it's not that Andrew wants to play meekly and avoid big pots. In fact, Andrew wants to play big pots and, like, really turn the screws to this guy, but probably not with, like, ace queen. That's, like, it's a waste of ace queen, I think, to run, like, a big bluff with that hand or a big semi bluff with that hand. Like, so, like, for example, if you have, like, jack nine that just completely whiffed, I'm not saying it's, like, the correct balanced thing to do, but I think you should have hands, especially ones that block, like, super strong hands, that you're just gonna, like, pot with, because like, can he really call? Sometimes, but not that often. Like, you're gonna have, like, you do want to inflate this pot sometimes, because he hates the pot getting inflated, especially given that he has so many zero and one pair hands. But with ace queen, where you have showdown value, like, you want to think about, you know, taking advantage of the fact that you have a good hand and not just turning it into yet another bluffing hand, of which you have plenty. Right. So, I would either, you know, if I were going to bet, I would probably have, this isn't so true of me, I think this is a good example of a spot to have more than one bet size. Or if you're going to have one bet size, make it big and really punish him for being in this situation with you and having a lot of weak hands. But with this hand, I would bet zero chips. I would just check.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually think this is a spot that rewards a small bet size a lot. I think this is a flop that's really bad for him in general. I mean, it ends up not being bad for him given the hand he has, but I think 5-4 deuce is a really hard board to hit. If you think about what a limp calling range might look like for him, it really shouldn't have a lot of twos, threes, fours, and fives in it, right? He's choosing to play a pot at a position against the player who covers him when he has an above average stack, and he's choosing to play it passively. It's not too hard for him to have an ace with one of these wheel cards. Certainly he can have club draws, 7-6. I mean, there are ways for him to have draws, or, you know, ways that he could connect with the board. 7-5 suited, 6-5 suited. Those hands aren't impossible for him. But I think, you know, we don't see hands like 4-3. I don't think we're seeing a lot of king deuce, even if it's suited. I don't think we're seeing queen 4 suited. I think those kinds of hands are not going to be limping and calling here. I think like a medium board hits him pretty well. I think even high cards, he's going to have a lot of high cards. Like, I don't think he's going to be doing a lot of raising or limp raising in this spot, because he's not really trying to blow the pot pre-flop, but I think small cards he's gonna miss a lot. So my thinking in approaching this spot is to just sort of be pushing equity and to have a very high c-bet frequency for a small size. And, you know, that still doesn't necessarily mean that ace queen belongs in that range. I was sort of thinking of it as a pretty mergy bet, where sort of like sometimes he'll probably call or raise with hands that I'm ahead of, and I think I was, you know, not fully appreciating that getting raised, like, I mean, I was kind of thinking like, well, ace queen will be a pretty clear call if he check raises, and I do think it's a call if he check raises, but I think I'm overestimating, like, it's not that I don't want that to happen.
yeah, I would just say that a lot of your arguments for betting small are also arguments for betting big. Like, so if you bet big, one thing that's nice is that you fold out hands like king jack or something, so then like every card is good for you, which is really nice. So you have so much more like queen 4, jack 4, ace 4, hands like that, or like queen jack. So like when on the flop it goes check, and then you bet three quarters pot or full pot and he calls, then like think about king, queen, jack, 10, 9. Those cards are all vastly better for you than they are for him, and like he's fucked, I think, if you do that. So I actually think that a big bet size, like what it does to the range, like what's it gonna do, bluff raise you a lot? I don't think so. I think like a big bet gives you a huge information advantage that he can't really do anything about. And like you said, oh, like you can barrel if you bet small, like you can barrel if you bet big too, and you're winning a bigger pot, like. And so I think, especially in this tournament spot, I like a bigger bet size on the flop. And I understand that you want to bet a lot, and betting is really good for you. But I actually think that most of the reasons to bet a lot are also reasons to bet almost as much big.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And the downside, if we want to call it that, of betting big is that I don't think I can have hands like ace queen, and like it needs to be a somewhat more polarized range if I'm betting larger. Yep. But
actually a benefit,
right? Exactly. So maybe just having a more polarized betting range and just not betting a hand like ace queen makes more sense here.
Yeah, can I just jump in with like a higher level point here? Is like, people say tournament poker is solved. Like, this is a pretty basic spot. It doesn't happen a lot, but it's just a blind battle. And I think, like, how many players would you say play this spot extremely well or have thought really carefully about it? I would say...
I don't even know how to guess.
Yeah, but it's not many, right?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people, at least of the players, you know, maybe this is not really what you're asking, but like of the you know, 50 or so players who are remaining at this point, maybe more than half.
Yeah. Okay. So here's a different way of saying what I'm saying. Like, I think I would probably raise plenty preflop. I would have checked ace queen in this spot. I would have had a pretty wide betting range, and I would have bet big with that range. And I think I would have done this all sort of at the time and not just sort of after the fact. I think that strategy is either clearly better than or clearly worse than a lot of what a lot of other people are doing in this spot. Mm-hmm. And it's like a pretty basic thing. So I think there's still a lot of thinking you can do in tournament poker to try to play better. That's what I'm thinking.
Anyway. I think it's also worth saying there's probably a little bit of an element of positive tilt going on here, where just, you know, so many things have gone right for me in this tournament that you're not really thinking about, like, what if he actually flopped a really strong hand right now? It's just people haven't been flopping strong hands against me, and it's not as, you know, availability bias, I think, is what the thinking fast and slow term would be for this. It's just, like, not as prominent in my head. You know, obviously, when you're running bad, every single time you're like, he flopped a set, didn't he? And it's like, I'm looking at this flop, and I'm like, well, I win another pot. Let's take it. Let's just collect it right now. Here it is. Give it to me.
It's like, ooh, what do you have? Pocket sevens? Like, I have 10 outs against that hand. Like, you know, like, exactly. It's like,
and I'm definitely going to hit one of them.
Yeah. And like, probably you just have like ace jack that you're going to call with, or ace king that you're going to fold. I mean, not, he doesn't have ace king, you get it. Good.
So I bet 20 and he check raises to 75. And this again.
Yeah.
Is that good?
Yeah. I mean, we talked about this largely on the flop. I would call, but blah.
Right. Yeah, it's just like, I mean, I think it's a polarized range. Again, like this being a tournament situation where he's choosing to blow up the pot, I think it's probably even more, like, I don't think he's as likely to be, in a different sort of situation, you might see this kind of raise from a hand like 6-5, but here, I don't think that's happening. Like, I think it's a lot more likely to just be strong draws, strong made hands, and, you know, maybe occasional airball bluffs, but just not a range that ace queen is doing that great. Again, not that I'm saying I should fold it, but I don't think it's not like a great, like, oh, I'm hoping I get check raised. Like, that's certainly not the situation here. And I think it's probably worse for me than I realized in the moment.
Yeah.
So he raises.
Yeah, I wouldn't hate it if you fold. Like, if we were talking about this hand, like, if this hand had never gone to showdown and we were just like chatting about it over coffee and you said like, oh, I just like knitted out and folded to the flop raise, I would have said like, okay, like,
right,
I'd probably peel it there, but like, you know, small mistake if it's a mistake, and like, you know, next hand, right, fine, like, is he really bluffing you a lot? Like, yeah, anyway,
so I call, and now there's 150 plus like 215 or so in the pot, 215,000 in the pot. And the turn is an offsuit queen. So nice. I now have...
Boom. Fist pump.
Exactly.
You have the nuts.
And that really was my thinking. I was just like, well, there it is. Time to collect another
check. And you really do. Like, what, the SPR is like 2 here?
Yeah, he's got a little over 400 behind. So yeah, SPR of 2.
Yeah, you can't. You have ace queen. It's blind bet. I mean, yeah. Especially like given what the shape of his limp calling range looks like. Yeah, jeez. And you should be bluffing him on this turn sometimes. Yeah, this is, it's not the literal nuts, but it's in your nuts range.
He bets 135 into 210, which is frankly a little worrisome. I still think this is a pretty clear shove, but I don't know that he has a lot of hands that I dominate. Like, I don't know that he's really going to have, you know, pocket jacks or something. Like, I think there's a lot of reasons why he's not going to have pocket jacks here, but I don't. You know, I think I kind of still have a hand that beats bluffs. I don't know that he's, you know, betting 135 here, looking to get it in with a hand that I'm like well ahead of. I think it's still probably going to be a sort of polarized range where I'm not going to be in great shape if the shove is called. I do think the pot is large enough and there's enough draws in his range that like shoving is better than like calling and trying to fold a club river or something. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I will say if he's playing tight-er the way he should preflop? Like, is he limp calling 5-3? You know, does he have like exactly 6-7? Like, is he really barreling you with 8-6? I mean, I guess he might be barreling you with 8-6, but like, you don't have that many outs against that hand. Like, I'm not sure calling is as bad as you think it is. Like, how many really scary rivers are there for his range? I'm not sure there are a lot. And you can seal your hand pretty well. I don't know. Like, I would shove. I'm not sure it's as easy as you think it is. And in particular, I'm not sure that his preflop range hits this board hard enough where the cards that would be scare cards in level one are still scare cards, given that there are all these ICM things going on in this hand. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Well, I did shove.
But you shoved. Yeah. Right. That's fine. I mean, that's like if you had a, like, if you get, if you had 8-6 and you called the check raise on the flop, like, what would you do here? You would probably shove, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know, actually.
I guess 8-6 is open-ended. What would you do with 8-7? What would you do with 8-7 of hearts here?
I think
that's a question.
I think it's a fold.
On the flop?
Oh, no, sorry, on the turn.
Yeah, okay, good. What would you do with...
I think it would have to be like 8-6 of clubs, or, you know, 8-7 of something where I think I need a bigger draw to shove here. Like, those are the kinds of hands that I'm shoving as a bluff. This is, I think, like, real high.
And note that stacks are pretty gross to 3-bet that on the flop.
Right, yeah, I think I'm not doing much flop 3-betting here. I think I'm mostly just peeling flops and then, you know, making a decision on the turn about what to shove with.
What would you do with ace king on the turn? Ace king, race jack.
That's a good question. They're probably folds.
Yeah. Okay. What about pocket sevens?
I might stick it in with sevens. I don't know if that's good though. Probably not, actually. Blocking, I mean, six is not good.
Yeah. Nines. Sticking in with nines.
Yeah. I think. Well, I don't know if he's actually going to have like sixes, sevens, eights, but it seems like maybe he could. But then I guess I was saying he probably doesn't have those when I'm shoving ace queen. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I probably would just stick it in with nines, but I don't know if that's actually that's a tricky hand. And I don't know. I mean, ace queen, I guess, is not actually that different from nines. The gutter's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, the gutter matters. If ace queen, like, if he ever hits this queen, it's because he has so much air in his range that you should probably be back to calling.
Right. If he just has like queen jack of hearts here.
Yeah. So, well, but then, so like, right. Either ace queen is the same thing as nines, in which case you should call, or ace queen, or either ace queen is like a lot better than nines, in which case you should call, or ace queen is only a gutter different from nines, in which case is ace queen like a really good, I don't know. Ugh. Yeah, I almost want to call now. Is that weird?
Yeah, you're starting to talk me into that too.
Yeah, I think this might actually be a call. Yeah, now I think it's a call. Like, again, in part because he can't bluff you all that effectively on the river, which is not to say that you're going to fold the river, but you're, well, yeah, I think call and evaluate is actually pretty good. Like call and call most rivers.
Yeah.
I think I like that.
Yeah. Fold clubs.
Yeah.
I did shove and he had ace three for a flopped straight. So I was three outs to a chop, which I did not get. The good news is I still had, despite losing an above average deck in the spot, I still had an above average deck left. I finished the day, I was still seventh in chips, and this hand was like pretty close to the end of the day, and I was still seventh out of 34 people remaining when the day ended. So I think I did a good job of like not dwelling on the, like, obviously there's a lot that we ended up talking about. You can probably tell I haven't, you know, I've only thought through this hand prior to talking to you about it now. I hadn't even ruminated on the hand that much. And that's a development for me. And I think it's a really an important tournament skill. Like, you probably are going to play a hand, either misplay a hand or at least lose a pot in a spot where you're going to worry that you misplayed it. And it's going to, you know, it's going to happen at some point if you're playing a tournament for, you know, 20 hours or whatever we played for. And ruminating on that hand, I'm sure you've all seen this or experienced it yourselves. It's like ruminating on a hand and trying to figure out what you should have done in a spot that's over and done with is like, it's a good thing to do after the fact. It's a good thing to, you know, get on Skype with your buddy and talk to him about it. But it's not a good thing to do while you're still playing, to be dwelling on like, oh, what if I done this? What if I did that? I should have 1.3 million right now. Why did I do that? Why did I lose that pot? Like, just, and I think this is about the best that I've ever been at just sort of like putting it by me and being like, well, that happened. I still have a lot of chips.
Yeah.
And it helps that the day was almost over. So it's like, all right, well, you know, I'll you know, dwell on it tonight if I have to, but let's yeah. just play the rest of today, you know, as yeah. well as it can be played. And I think that's really an underrated, I don't know if it's underrated, but it's an important tournament skill to be able to deal with both bad beats and also, you know, potentially mistakes on your part and just, you know, get yeah. over it and keep playing well.
Yeah, it's badly underrated. It's badly underrated. Okay, so I feel like I've said, I feel like I'm kind of running good in the saying smart things on the air. So can I say something that's possibly really stupid and terrible?
Yeah, please.
So this is just like the dad talking. I kind of hate his preflop play, especially if he thinks that you're good. Like ace three offsuit is pretty bad, I think. I think I would limp fold. And if I thought you were over-raising, then I would probably just fold the first time and fight back with other hands. Is that crazy?
I think limp-raising it is pretty appealing.
Oh, yeah. Limp-raising. Yeah, but if you're limp-raising, then you're limp-raising. So if I think you're good, then I'd rather limp-raise other things. Like, I guess maybe limp-calling down to, like, A7... But then, like, ace 6, ace 5, ace 4, ace 3, that's a lot. Like, then you have to make sure you're not limp raising, like, way too much. Although the ace blocker is good, so maybe, like, 16 times 4, 64 combos of limp raising. It feels like a lot of ace X to be limp raising with. So I did think about limp raising, and then I concluded that ace 3 is just, like, a touch too weak, and I'd rather have, like, ace 5 for that. But, like, my point being, like, limp calling, like, this isn't hot and cold. You're out of position against a good player. An ace, like, flopping aces is wonderful, but you know, sometimes you lose and it's pretty hard to flop an ace. And then when you flop a three, like, you're not gonna let him get to showdown that often. Like what's he gonna do, flop a wheel when, like, you're gonna hit the nuts on the turn? Like, that's not gonna happen real often. So I kind of don't like the limp call. Maybe I'm just a nit.
Yeah, you know, it's worth remembering everyone. Like, I mentioned the bit about my, you know, potentially having, like, some positive tilt or just, like, not really thinking about what could go wrong and just thinking about what can go right a little too much. It's probably true of everyone who's still in the tournament at this point, like, at the end of day two. Like, this guy also has probably been running pretty well with expectation for the last 2 days and is probably like, oh, well, I'll just limp and call and probably something good will happen. And it did.
Yeah. Yeah, like, in like, when you have Jack 9 and the board comes, like, nothing, are you really just going to check it back three times? Like, how many times is he going to call with unimproved ace high?
Right.
Like, it might be slightly good. I don't know. Yeah, I don't like the limp call. Limp raising, I think, is not bad. But either limp folding or... Yeah, probably you can't. If he thinks you're good, you're not going to be raising so much that he should just fold the first time because he's getting, like, a crazy price to just complete. Yeah. So I would limp fold. There, I said it. Come take my small blind. See how it works out for you, everybody. Yeah. Interesting hand. I think poker is nowhere near solved. There, I said it.
I think that's a safe assumption. Tournament poker in particular is a tricky one. It's a lot harder to run a lot of iterations of a tournament spot because they're a lot more,
yeah.
you know, like the way Poker Snowy works of just, you know, playing millions of hands against the nemesis and sort of learning over time. That's a much harder thing to do in a tournament where the same spot doesn't recur. Like, it's not the same spot just because the stack sizes are the same.
Yep. I agree. That was fun. Thanks for talking about your hands. It's and again, congratulations. Like, I think, yeah, I think you play good. I think you play good. And not many people get on the air and tell thousands of people that they probably messed up a huge pot after they do this. Like, they're just like, sit around thinking about their bad beats and, you know, drink or, you know, so this is a lot better than like, you know, doing what most people do.
Well, I made sure after, we talked about a hand where I was a certified genius first. So.
Yeah. That hand's real sweet. That hand is, yeah, I love both these hands. I think there's a lot to them, and I think they're both a bit deceptive. And that first hand, I think, especially, is I think your line is kind of available to anybody who's really got the poker 101 stuff down, but it requires so much like active thinking and careful thinking that a lot of people would mess it up, including me probably most of the time. So I think that's a great hand. It's like elementary from a formal perspective, but almost impossible to get right from a practical one. And I just think that's great.
Well, that's nice to hear. Thanks.
Ocean of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.